This is a CBC podcast.
Hi, I'm Bob McDonald. Welcome to Quirks and Quarks. On this week's show, it's Nobel Week, and we'll speak to a scientist who got the early morning call that means scientific immortality.
At 4 in the morning when the phone rings, it sort of took a minute to register, and my wife answered it. She said, he has a Swedish accent. So then it was like, oh.
And your bathroom's biodiversity. Scientists find a plethora of exotic new life forms in very ordinary places.
One hypothesis that would explain some of these findings is that you have viruses that are evolving on your toothbrush that are unique to your toothbrush and not found anywhere else in the world.
Plus, X-raying an asteroid to keep it from killing us all, where the dingo came from, and fighting autoimmune disease by reprogramming rebellious cells. All this today on Quirks and Quarks. It's that time of year again.
Ladies and gentlemen, good morning, and very welcome to Nobel Forum for the announcement of this year's Nobel Prize.
The Royal Swedish Academy of Sciences handed out the Nobel Prizes this week, and this year a lot of attention focused on artificial intelligence. On Wednesday, the Nobel Prize in Chemistry was shared by three scientists who use computers and AI to model new proteins. Here's Demis Hassabis speaking on the Nobel's First Reactions channel.
The reason I've worked on AI my whole life is that, I'm passionate about science and finding out knowledge. And I've always thought if we could build AI in the right way, it could be the ultimate tool to help scientists, help us explore the universe around us.
On Tuesday, the man who's been called the godfather of AI got the call from Sweden. Canadian researcher Jeffrey Hinton shared the physics prize with John Hopfield for their work building artificial neural networks, fundamental to machine learning. Here he is talking with CBC's Neil Coxall on As It Happens after his win.
I think AI can do tremendous good if we can manage to avoid the dangers. We have to be careful that this stuff doesn't get out of control, and we have to be careful of all the other bad possible side effects of it. But the upside is so good, there's no chance that people will stop developing AI.
But before that, on Monday, the prize for medicine and physiology didn't go to artificial intelligence research. Instead, it was awarded to scientists who discovered one of the keys to how organisms develop and function, molecules called microRNAs. Now, if you're listening to this program, I think you probably know what genes are. They're the blueprints, the recipe for living things. But a recipe alone doesn't do anything. It has to be made. Its instructions and ingredients have to be activated. And since the discovery of the genetic code, we've been trying to understand what turns genes on and off, what turns the DNA recipe into the living organism, in everything from microbes to elephants. On Monday, the Nobel Prize in Medicine or Physiology was awarded to two scientists, Victor Ambros and Gary Ruvkun, who helped untangle an important part of that story. They discovered a previously unrecognized group of molecules, dubbed microRNA, which help control which genes are active and when. This, of course, plays a vital role in how complex life forms grow and function. Dr. Gary Ruvkun is a molecular biologist at Massachusetts General Hospital, a professor of genetics at Harvard Medical School, and now a 2024 Nobel laureate. Hello, and huge congratulations to you.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
First of all, what was it like to get that call from Stockholm?
It's been like sort of in play for about 20 years. And so at 4 in the morning when the phone rings, it sort of took a minute to register. And my wife answered it. And she said, he has a Swedish accent. So then it was like, oh. And so that's a good news, right?
Absolutely. Well, tell me the story of how we started to understand how genes get turned on and off that led to your work on microRNA.
Yeah, so this emerged from doing genetic analysis in this little nematode. So the nematode is a big part of the ecosystem in soils. So it's so simple. It has 959 cells, and every cell has a name. Mm-hmm. So I started to work in 1982, as did Victor Ambrose, and we worked together on the sort of the pedigree of cells that generates the animal.
Well, how did that lead to the discovery of the role of microRNA?
Yeah, so then when we figured out what these genes were, it turned out one of them encoded a product that was about 5 times smaller than any gene had ever been seen to be. It was only 25 nucleotides long. And that was a new phenomenon. And it was considered kind of a quirk, and it wasn't clear what it really meant.
Well, when did you realize that this was a brand new genetic molecule?
You know, this is early days. We didn't have any genomes at this point. But within 5 years, genomes were emerging, the first from bacteria and then from a yeast, and our little worm was third. And when the way we figured out that this was general was we got a second one of these microRNAs, these very small genes, and that one had a human homologue. And that was detected, you know, by taking our 25 letters and using a modem, you know, a 9600 baud modem. So your elderly listeners will remember 1% of them had modems. Most people didn't. And, you know, you'd phone up and you go, it would connect to a computer somewhere. And it was a computer that had less memory than your phone. And so I did that looking for whether there was a human homologue and got an answer by, you know, comparing the worm genome of this 25 letters. And there were those same 25 letters in the human genome.
Wow. Okay, so you find it in this little roundworm, you find it in the human genome. What do these microRNAs actually do?
They regulate other target genes, and they do all kinds of different processes. And they are used in essentially every animal and every plant. So they're as ancient as the divergence of plants and animals, which is, you know, a billion years ago. And in plants, it's been an amazing set of discoveries and have been implicated in, for example, the domestication of corn 5,000 years ago. These mutations are what the indigenous peoples selected for. They didn't know they were doing that, but they got what are called heterochronic mutants, mutants that do things differently in time when they're developing. And that's what makes, you know, bigger corn cobs.
What has this discovery of microRNA allowed us to do?
There are a bunch of different diseases that have been treated. We haven't done any of that, Victor or I. We've stayed quite focused on the worm. But there's a bunch of liver diseases, for example, that can be treated with these tiny RNAs. It's not the most common. It's not heart disease. But it's, you know, lots of liver diseases that affect a lot of people.
I understand that more recently you've been applying your knowledge for the search for microbial life outside of our solar system. Tell me about that.
Yeah, that's been a passion. So as I was getting more and more introduced to how to think about RNA, because, you know, our genetics taught us we're dealing with an RNA-based mechanism. And so we sort of dove into the richness of RNA biology. And there's a long tradition of people trying to figure out how the ribosome works, for example. And the ribosome is the tiny machine in all of our cells that takes messenger RNAs and translates them into proteins. And it turns out that the key element of the ribosome is an RNA that it was probably existed before proteins even evolved. And that RNA is the most conserved thing on Earth. And it's how biologists all over the world go to bizarre ecosystems like snow and ice or ponds or deep in the ocean or human feces, you name it. You can look for who's in there by looking for the DNA segments that are present in the ribosome. And so I've been trying to convince NASA that that's how they should look for life on Mars. And their response is always kind of bimodal. Part of it is, well, yes, but it's very Earth-centered view of looking for life. Are you stupid? And my response is, it'd be stupid to not first look for that. That if you think that Mars is going to have independently evolved life, that's stupid because, of course, it's going to spread between Earth and Mars. They're right near each other, and there's meteoritic exchange between the two. We have Martian meteorites on Earth. Not a lot of them, but you don't need a lot to have bacteria move between planetary systems.
Are there any future applications of microRNA research that you're hoping to see?
Yeah, I mean, we're going to continue to work on sort of what are the pathways. Right now, one of the big things we do is we now know a lot about what are the proteins that are involved in presenting these tiny RNAs to their targets. And we know that some of those proteins, again, they're, for example, not present in humans or most of the animal kingdom. But the worm has them. Ticks and spiders have them. Coral has them. And these are the organisms that do antiviral defense way better than we do. And so we're trying to figure out why so many of the animals, like most insects, all of the vertebrates, essentially dumped their very ancient antiviral pathway to develop what's called the interferon pathway, which is how we fight viruses. And my view is that we don't do such a good job in comparison.
Well, Dr. Rubkin, thank you very much for your time, and congratulations again on winning the Nobel Prize.
Thanks. Yeah, it's been a good week.
Dr. Gary Rubkin is a molecular biologist at Massachusetts General Hospital, a professor of genetics at Harvard Medical School, and winner of the 2024 Nobel Prize in Medicine. You'd think that by now we would have found all the biodiversity hotspots on our planet, but a new one has just been discovered. And you'll never guess where. It's not in a faraway land, not in the depths of the ocean, it's not even in a naturally occurring environment. It's your bathroom. A new study led by environmental microbiologist Dr. Erica Hartman uncovered a jungle's worth of tiny creatures living on people's showerheads and toothbrushes, including hundreds of previously unknown viruses. Dr. Hartman is an associate professor of civil and environmental engineering at Northwestern University. Hello and welcome back to Quirks and Quarks.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
What made you want to look at microbes in our bathrooms?
So we spend a lot of our time living, you know, in our homes or in our offices, in the built environment in general. And our shower heads specifically and our toothbrushes are two places within those environments where there's a really clear interaction and a pathway for exposure. So if you think about it, the water running through your shower head couldn't pick up any microbes that are inside there. And then, of course, you're exposed to those every time you shower. And the same with your toothbrush. You ideally are putting it, you know, in your mouth probably at least twice a day, according to your dentist. And so there's an opportunity to exchange microbes with that surface.
Well, we've heard for a while about how many particles are floating around our bathrooms. What makes your study different?
So what we really wanted to do in this study is look not at the sort of bacteria that might make you sick, but actually at the viruses that infect the bacteria that are surrounding us. And this is, I would say, the next frontier of microbiology is really looking at these bacteriophage that infect viruses.
Bacteriophage? What do you mean by that?
Bacteriophage are viruses that infect bacteria. So they don't infect humans, and there's no cause for alarm for our health. But they have these really interesting relationships with bacteria and could potentially be used for some new and exciting biotechnologies or drugs.
I usually think of bacteria as infecting us. You're saying that bacteria themselves can get infections?
Yeah, exactly. So just like basically anything else, there are viruses that infect bacteria. And this can be potentially very useful because exactly some bacteria do infect us, and some of those bacteria are what we call antibiotic resistant, which means that the antibiotics, the wonder drugs that we've had for the last almost 100 years, can't actually treat those anymore. And so there's a lot of interest in being able to use these viruses to take down infectious bacteria and be able to cure infection once again.
So what did you find when you went searching for these bacteriophages in bathroom samples?
We found a ton of viruses, which is in and of itself not that surprising. Everywhere where we find bacteria, we, you know, sort of expect that we will find bacteriophage, and we find bacteria basically everywhere. What was really surprising is just how diverse these viruses, these bacteriophage are, and how little they resembled things that we had seen previously.
Well, how different were the shower heads compared to the toothbrushes?
Yeah, so it turns out they're completely different, which is kind of expected. You know, so the thing about a shower head is it's just the water is running through it. And so you're not really contributing to your shower head. You're mostly getting exposed to it. Whereas with the toothbrush, you're actually putting it in your mouth. And so you end up transferring a lot of the bacteria from your mouth onto your toothbrush. So we didn't necessarily expect a bunch of overlap between shower heads and toothbrushes. But what was really surprising is we didn't see hardly any overlap even between any two shower heads or any two toothbrushes. So just an enormous amount of diversity there and some very unique organisms.
Did that surprise you?
Sort of yes and no. The thing about viruses, A, we know very little about them. And so every new sample that we analyze, we're going to find new things, which is very exciting. But the other thing about viruses is that they, you know, they can mutate pretty quickly. You know, I think we're all acutely aware of that after all of the COVID variants. And so it's possible, like one hypothesis that would explain some of these findings is that you have viruses that are evolving on your toothbrush that are unique to your toothbrush and not found anywhere else in the world. We don't know enough yet to know for sure if that's the truth or what's going on there, but I think it's a really exciting possibility.
It sounds like we have a lot to learn about viruses.
We have so much to learn. This type of research has only really become possible fairly recently, in part because we didn't really have the tools that we needed to ask these types of questions and to study these types of organisms, and in part because we didn't necessarily have the motivation to ask those questions. So, you know, back in the day, about 100 years ago, we sort of figured out that these viruses existed, but we also found antibiotics. And there was sort of a decision, at least in the sort of Western world, that antibiotics were a better way to treat infections. But now that those antibiotics are failing, there's a really, really compelling reason to go looking for viruses like these and to understand how they work and what we might do with them.
The enemy of my enemy is my friend.
Yeah, exactly.
We hear about how viruses are everywhere. How common are bacteriophage?
So we don't fully know yet, but by some estimates, for every bacteria, there's between like 1 in 1,000 viruses that would infect it. So there are potentially astronomical numbers of these bacteriophage around us.
So how would we go about putting them to work for us in fighting bacteria that have become antibiotic resistant?
That is an active area of research. I would say right now we're a little limited in our understanding of actually fundamentally how they work. And so one of the really important things to do is just to do these sort of basic studies to see what's out there and what they're capable of. But the other thing that's possible is that we might be able to engineer bacteriophage to sort of deliver things for us, for example. So the idea that when you have an infection and you take an antibiotic, if it's a broad spectrum antibiotic, it takes out like your entire microbiome. But if you had a phage that only infects the thing that's infecting you, then you could deliver your antibiotic or something like that directly to that organism and leave the rest of your microbiome intact, which would, in theory, be a much nicer way of treating an infection.
Well, the very idea that our toothbrushes and shower heads are coated with viruses and bacteria might make some people shudder. Should we be concerned about this?
No, there's absolutely no reason for concern. These are viruses that infect bacteria, and they only infect bacteria. So there's nothing in our results that really suggests that we need to, you know, change our cleaning protocols or do anything about that.
So what, we don't need to bust out the bleach and clean our shower heads more?
No, absolutely not. And in fact, some microbial exposures are actually good for you. So there are untold numbers of microbes out there, and only a very, very few will actually make you sick. Most of them are sort of neutral, and some of them are even quite beneficial. So it's really important to work with the microbes rather than against them. And going overboard on disinfection doesn't necessarily actually help.
So we should be living with our microbes, not fighting against them all the time.
Yes, absolutely. Some of my colleagues have said it's a microbial world, we just inhabit it. It's absolutely true, and we should embrace the microbes around us. They really do us a lot of good.
Dr. Hartman, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Dr. Erica Hartman is an associate professor of civil and environmental engineering at Northwestern University. It's one of Hollywood's favorite disaster scenarios. A giant asteroid is discovered on a collision course with the Earth. A plucky, mismatched band of maverick astronauts is dispatched to save us all from the sad fate of the dinosaurs. Well, it's not a totally outlandish scenario. Astronomers keep a close eye on the sky for this kind of danger. NASA tracks thousands of objects in our region of space, and more are discovered all the time. Fortunately, we haven't found anything really dangerous yet, but it's entirely possible there's something out there with our name on it. Which is why researchers are continuing to explore ways to deflect an asteroid if we do find one that's heading our way. And in the latest of these experiments, a powerful new method has been demonstrated. Deflect them with a blast of X-ray power. Dr. Nathan Moore and his team ran experiments with the Z-Machine, the world's most powerful laboratory radiation source, to figure out how to deal with this existential threat. Dr. Moore is a physicist at Sandia National Laboratories in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Hello and welcome to our show.
Pleased to be here.
Now, there have been lots of ideas about how to deflect an asteroid, such as hitting them, as we saw with the NASA's DART mission. Why are you interested in using X-rays?
There are some asteroids out there large enough that hitting them with a spacecraft, kinetic impact like NASA demonstrated in their DART mission, simply wouldn't be powerful enough to knock it out of the way in time. That kinetic impact works well on small asteroids or when you have very long warning times like decades. But if you have a very large asteroid, perhaps several kilometers in size, or if you have an asteroid that surprises us by showing up in our neighborhood without much warning, you have to hit it much harder to get it out of the way in time to eliminate the threat to Earth.
Well, how are X-rays able to move an asteroid?
It's a very unique mechanism. The X-rays vaporize the surface of the asteroid. It's like boiling water. The vapor that comes off of the asteroid is like a rocket exhaust, and that propels the asteroid to the side, just like a rocket. The asteroid becomes its own rocket.
Oh, I see. That old action-reaction principle. The gases go one way, the asteroid goes the other.
Exactly.
Well, tell me about your experiment and the Z-machine that you used. What is that?
The Z-machine is the world's most powerful, they call it a pulse power device. It generates 80 trillion watts of electricity. And that huge electrical surge, though it's just for a tiny fraction of a second, that electricity is concentrated into very small, about the size of a marble. We can use that concentrated energy to heat materials to be millions of degrees hotter than the surface of the sun. In our case, we use the Z-machine to heat argon gas. And when the argon becomes that hot, it wants to get rid of its excess energy. The fastest way it can do that is by releasing a burst of X-rays. So this produces a burst of X-rays that lasts just a few nanoseconds. But it's very powerful, it's very energetic, and that X-ray energy expands outward like a bubble and interacts with our mock asteroid.
So what did you use as a mock asteroid?
We use small chips of silica, which is a mineral commonly found in asteroids. Asteroids can be made of many different materials. Silica is one, also iron, nickel, and many other compounds. But our first test was just a demonstration. We chose a very simple material. We chose silica. It's like glass.
Mm-hmm. How big was it?
Our mock asteroid was about the size of the width of your finger, about 1 centimeter.
Okay. So when you blasted it with the X-rays, how far did it move?
Our experiment is really a a miniature experiment. Everything is smaller. Even the amount that the asteroid moves is smaller. Our mock asteroid only moved 1 millimeter. but during that travel, we accelerated it to 70 meters per second, which is the speed of a high-speed train.
Oh, okay. But you used a machine that's the size of a building to move a marble a couple of centimeters. How do you scale that up? I mean, obviously, you're not going to send a building into space. How would you scale it up to move a large asteroid?
What we can do with our experiment is test the mathematical models that can be used to predict how much an asteroid in outer space would be deflected. So even though our asteroid is very small in our laboratory experiment, it allows us to test those models.
So how do you produce the X-rays in space?
In space, the only way we know of to produce a strong enough X-ray burst would be to use some type of nuclear device. You'd have to launch that on a rocket millions of miles from Earth and get it just a few kilometers away from the asteroid before you detonate.
Oh, so you're not trying to blow the asteroid up?
You'll see that in the movies. That is a valid approach for some scenarios, but there are risks with trying to blow up an asteroid. What if you don't blow it up completely? What if you just splinter the asteroid into several large pieces that then fly uncontrollably to Earth? You may not know where they're going to land or what they're going to do at that point. The approach using an X-ray burst to deflect an asteroid is a much gentler process, and we think it may be more predictable.
Okay, so you're going to detonate the nuclear device beside the asteroid and use the radiation from the blast to move it. Is that the idea?
That's correct.
So how much could you actually move an asteroid, say, I don't know, one that's a few kilometers across with this technique?
This approach is extremely powerful. The consensus in the planetary defense community is that this approach would be the most effective way to deflect a large asteroid, or to deflect an asteroid that surprises us and doesn't leave us much warning time.
How large would the nuclear device have to be?
We did some example calculations for a 1 megaton nuclear device. That's enough energy to deflect an asteroid several kilometers in size.
So how much warning time would we need for this to truly be effective?
If you have very long warning times, perhaps decades, you have options. You could use this approach. You might be able to use a kinetic impact. The reason you might choose this approach using X-rays is when the asteroid is too large to be dealt with those other methods, or if the warning time is short. For example, if you just had 1 year, the asteroid's going to need a good shove. You need the most powerful option available. In some ways, it's like a game of tennis. If you want to win the game, you have to master every stroke.
So from your point of view, how much of a threat are we really facing here?
The likelihood of a devastating impact is low. That's good for all of us. But it's also true that we've only found about half of the asteroids out there in space that could be potentially devastating. So far, we are not aware of any asteroids on a path to hit us, but there's still the possibility that we'll find one. And you don't want to be surprised.
Dr. Moore, thank you so much for your time.
My pleasure.
Dr. Nathan Moore is a physicist at Sandia National Laboratories in Albuquerque, New Mexico. I'm Bob McDonald, and you're listening to Quirks and Quarks on CBC Radio 1 and streaming live on the CBC News app. Just go to the Local tab and press play wherever you are. Coming up later in the program, quelling an immunological rebellion. Researchers explore new ways to defuse autoimmune diseases by reprogramming the cells that have been convinced to attack us.
We're hoping that this kind of reprogramming can have outsized effects for patients with disease. So our hope is that it not only affects people with early disease, but that it could also affect people with late-stage disease that could potentially lead to something like a cure.
Australia has many distinctive animals, but few have the reputation of the iconic dingo.
but this animal isn't always a source of national pride. The dingo is unique. We're pretty sure its ancestor was a domesticated dog brought to Australia thousands of years ago. But today's dingoes are far from domesticated. They become wild again. This has led to a complicated history. European settlers engaged in a campaign of eradication because of the danger they posed to livestock. But today, many see dingoes as a unique kind of wildlife that must be protected. But one mystery has remained. Just where did the dingo come from? Recently, the discovery of well-preserved fossils, combined with modern technology, has given new insight into the dingo's origins. Dr. Lucas Kongolos, a research associate at Australian National University, was part of the team that studied these fossils. The study was done as part of his PhD at the University of Sydney. Hello and welcome to our program.
It's great to be on.
Now, for our Canadian listeners, just tell me a bit about dingoes. Where do they live and what do they eat?
The dingoes are a really special kind of ancient dog that's found exclusively in Australia. And dingoes are really interesting and unique amongst dogs because they predominantly hunt for their own food. So they're predators and they eat everything from insects all the way up to our largest kangaroos and emus.
Well, before your study, what was the thinking on where the dingoes came from?
The impression from how dingoes look was that they probably came from India. And the reason for that is that there's dogs today, pariah dogs, so more or less free-ranging dogs that look very, very similar to dingoes. So they're quite tall, they're lean, the coat color is exactly the same, their kind of facial features look very, very similar. And so that was the prevailing theory, that at some point a few thousand years ago, people had left southern India and arrived in Australia and brought with them these dingoes. Once genetic technologies and approaches came out, we found a really different story, which is that the dingo's closest relatives are these much smaller, free-ranging dogs in New Guinea.
Why is it important to understand when the dingoes arrived?
In Australia, around the same time we think dingoes arrived, there's all of these changes which occur in the Australian archaeological record. So we have evidence of people totally revolutionizing the types of tools that they're using, the population size of people, where they're living, how long they're living in certain places. The question is, how linked is the dingo to that? Did they happen at the same time and for the same reason? Is the dingo actually potentially driving some of these changes as a new competitor for animal resources or as a hunting tool used by people in a tame state to more effectively hunt wildlife?
Well, tell me how you went about investigating the history and the origin of the dingo.
Good question. It took a mixture of things. Archival research, looking at old reports, looking at original field notes to figure out where things had come from, who had dug them up, where they came from. And then the more scientific end of things, applying radiocarbon dating and isotopic analysis to figure out how old are these bones exactly. We know based on, kind of radiocarbon dates from charcoal in the ground from, as an indication how old they might be, but we need to find out directly. We need an accurate estimate. So we've run a whole range of dingo bone specimens through radiocarbon dating laboratories, trying to pinpoint when's the time we can see the earliest sign of dingoes in terms of the fossil record.
How far back in time did you go?
Well, we found collectively the teams that I'm working with and my own research as part of the PhD. I think three of the four oldest dingoes in the country, and that, they range from about 3,300 years ago to about 3,000 years ago. So there's this small window of about 300 or 400 years where the first dingoes appear.
Okay, so that nails down the time. What about their origin? How did you determine where they came from?
So what we did was look at the physical makeup of these dingoes. I have to say, I'm not optimistic about ever getting DNA from them. They've come from a very hot and wet part of the country, which is very bad for DNA preservation. But the bones themselves physically were otherwise really well preserved. So we've looked at how they compare in terms of skull shape and size to a whole range of hundreds and hundreds of modern dingoes, as well as these dogs from New Guinea and a few from East Asia. So we know dingoes way back came from East Asia, or their ancestors did. probably what's now eastern China. The closest matches to these ancient dingoes were dogs from Japan. We weren't really too sure as to their breeds. They're kind of just Japanese dogs that, you know, people keep around without kind of specifically breeding them into a particular type of dog. And then the second closest match was these dogs from New Guinea, and they're all very, very similar. But all of those three, the ancient dingo, the Japanese dogs, and the New Guinea dogs, are all very different to modern dingoes. So modern dingoes are a lot larger, they're a lot leaner, they have larger teeth, more strongly developed kind of musculature on the neck. All of these things are suggesting to us that they have evolved this body form in order to take down large animal game, which is present in Australia. So kangaroos, wallabies, emus, things that they didn't really have available to them during that journey that they took all these thousands of years ago through Asia and through Southeast Asia to reach Australia.
Wow. So they've evolved over the last 3,000 years in Australia. But what does that say to you about their origin and how they got to Australia?
There's two models, really. They went from eastern China to what's now Taiwan, and moved from Taiwan probably through the Philippines and then into eastern Australia via people with really good seafaring capabilities, so capable of making quite long ocean voyages. Or they went through the mainland, through Thailand, Vietnam, what's now Malaysia, and then kind of like Western Indonesia, and probably stopped off via Sulawesi or Timor, and then into the northwestern coast of Australia. So potentially a Western route and an Eastern route.
Just one last thing. I understand in Australia, when you're dealing with fossils, it can be a bit of a sensitive subject. Tell me about that.
Yes, absolutely. So it's important in general to consult the traditional owners, basically, and obtain permissions with consent for fossils to be studied in any way, but especially a destructive analysis if they've come from what's an Aboriginal cultural heritage site. The fossil dingoes that we studied come from the same landscape of Lake Mungo as really famous ancient human remains, the oldest human remains in Australia. So even though they're wild animals, they've come from this cultural landscape. And so part of this research project was in collaboration with the traditional owners of the area, who gave their inputs and shared their thoughts with us in constructing the research design for this project. And that's basically standard practice for any work in Australian archaeology.
Dr. Kongolos, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you very much for having me on.
Dr. Lucas Kongolos is a research associate at Australian National University. We often talk about our immune system in military terms. We've got an army of cells ready to do battle and take out any foreign threat to our bodies. But what if that army turns against you, and instead of defending your body, it starts attacking it? That's what happens with autoimmune diseases, and lupus is a prime example. Lupus comes with a range of symptoms: arthritis-like joint pain, extreme fatigue, skin problems, headaches, fevers, and more. All a result of the body's immune system turning on itself. As with most autoimmune ailments, lupus has no cure, and the current standard of care can only blunt the symptoms. But thanks to some recent scientific advances, there's now hope that we can recruit a fifth column inside our rebellious immune army to neutralize its autoimmune attack. And the early results of this strategy have been amazing.
It feels like lupus never happened. It's like a bad dream.
That is 24-year-old Tutoa Buti from Germany. Her life was turned upside down when she developed lupus when she was 16 years old.
I couldn't do any sports anymore. And it was very hard for me because I also had very long hair, like now. But it fell out, and it was like I was losing my identity because I was always the sporty girl with long hair, and now I was this sickly girl who couldn't do anything, was always in the hospital getting therapy, and I felt helpless.
She was bedbound and in so much pain she could barely move or breathe. Her heart and kidneys were being attacked. Her lung function was down to 30%. She was running out of options.
When the call came, like, there is no therapy anymore for you because nothing worked, it was like I was going to die.
Fortunately, she was in the right place at the right time. Researchers at University Hospital Erlangen in Germany were setting up a center to provide cutting-edge cancer therapy when they learned about the severity of Toa's condition. It's called CAR-T immunotherapy. Cells from a patient's own immune system are harvested and reprogrammed to attack a new target. If you've heard of this therapy before, it might have been in the context of cancer treatments, where it's been a significant breakthrough. But more recently, it's been harnessed against rogue immune cells, like in the case of Toa's lupus. In 2021, Toa became the first person whose lupus went into full remission. Dr. Georg Schett is the rheumatologist physician scientist who made it happen. He's a professor of medicine at the Friedrich Alexander University of Erlangen in Germany, where he's also the vice president of research. Hello, Dr. Schett. Welcome to our program.
Hi, Bob. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Just in general, how does CAR-T therapy actually work?
So the T cell is one of the most frequent immune cells in the human body. It's important for defense, but in the situation of a CAR-T cell, when it is infused, it recognizes disease-associated cells and finds them and kills them.
Now, why did you think that this could work against an autoimmune disease like lupus?
Yeah, in lupus and in other autoimmune diseases, there is a dysfunction of B cells. These B cells are originating from the bone marrow, and usually they're behaving very well. They fight pathogens like viruses and bacteria. Some of the B cells attack the own body. And these B cells then create a big mess in the body, which is actually lifelong, and you need continuous immunosuppression. So what you do a trick. You actually insert a receptor, which is called the CAR. That's why it's named CAR T cell. And this CAR allows actually the T cell to recognize the B cell and kill it. We always compare it with a reset button on the computer, that you basically push it when nothing works, and then the computer works miraculously again. And so this is the principle also of CAR T cell therapy. The B cells coming back after the therapy are not anymore autoimmune and are not anymore making harm to the patient.
So see if I've got this right. You're saying the bone marrow creates these B cells, and then some of them get into the blood and they turn rogue and they start attacking the body. You get these T cells, engineer them so that they attack the rogue ones, and then the bone marrow starts producing new B cells that are all good.
Yeah, that's a very good summary. And the interesting thing that these B cells are normally functioning. Yeah? They have not this problem with autoimmunity anymore.
Well, if lupus turned Tao's life upside down, it sounds like your treatment turned it right side up. Here she is talking about how she felt afterwards.
After 3 months, I felt healthier. And after 6 months, I felt like a new person. And now I'm 3 years post-therapy and I feel like myself again. My hair grew long and healthy and I feel healthy as well. It feels like I got a second chance in life and I'm so grateful for it.
So Dr. Schett, what went through your mind when you saw how well Tao recovered from this?
Yeah, that's her, right? Very authentic description what she felt, and we were amazed, right? Because we thought it might work, it might dampen the disease, but ultimately probably we have to repeat it or we put her back on immunosuppression or whatever, but nothing like this happened. She got a single infusion, disease didn't come back anymore. And yeah, it's probably we did really this reset button which you could press and the disease is gone.
It's just astounding. Now, in Tao's case, you had to take her own T cells from her blood and give them back to her. So does that mean that if this treatment proceeds, that it's an individual treatment for each individual person?
Yes, it's super individual. You're absolutely right, Bob. It's the own cells which are engineered to be a drug. So you cannot actually just take these cells to another person, right? Because they would be immediately rejected.
Well, if it works for lupus, could it work for other autoimmune diseases?
Yes, we think so. I mean, there are very good examples now. For instance, it works in myositis, which is actually a very severe form of muscle inflammation, which leads to weakness and also sometimes involvement of the lungs. It works in systemic sclerosis, which is a disease affecting the heart, the lungs, and the skin, and leads to progressive thickening of the organs. It has been shown it works in myasthenia gravis, which is an important neuroimmune disease where people can't walk anymore because they have antibodies against nerves. And there has been also other central nervous system diseases where CAR T-cell therapy has been successfully applied. So it's a rather broad range of autoimmune diseases which seem to respond to CAR T-cell therapy.
So what still needs to be worked out before this kind of immune system manipulation can become standard treatment for autoimmune conditions like lupus?
There are currently quite a large number of trials available in North America, in Europe, and in China, in which patients with severe autoimmune disease are enrolled to receive CAR T-cell therapy. So it's a rapidly moving field. So it's not actually a treatment for everybody, right? It's a treatment for the most severe forms of the disease. So it's possible actually to treat severe patients with CAR T-cell therapy in a very effective way in specialized centers. So I think that will be also something for future therapy of severe autoimmune disease.
Well, Dr. Schad, congratulations on your success, and thank you so much for telling us about it.
You're very welcome.
Dr. Georg Schett is a physician-scientist professor of medicine at the Friedrich Alexander University of Erlangen in Germany. Now, CAR T therapy has some major challenges. It's a customized therapy. Your own immune cells have to be harvested and reprogrammed, so it's almost prohibitively expensive. But there is another strategy in the research pipeline with early promise. Investigations of a root cause of lupus have revealed something that could be critical. Researchers may have found a way to restore a fundamental imbalance of a specific type of T cell in the immune system in lupus patients. Specifically, it's a type of T helper cell that, in the case of lupus, turns out to be no help at all. And correcting this imbalance could potentially represent a cure for those cases of lupus and provide a blueprint to treat other similar autoimmune diseases. Dr. Jay Choi was part of the team that's been working on this, so far just in cell cultures in the lab. He's an associate professor of dermatology and biochemistry at Northwestern University in Chicago. Hello and welcome to our program.
Thank you for having me. Pleasure to be here.
Now, what is this fundamental imbalance in the immune cells of patients with lupus?
The immune cells, including the B cells and T cells, have really evolved to be able to protect us from infection. But in autoimmune disease like lupus, they actually go awry. So instead of protecting us from outside invaders like bacteria and viruses, they actually turn their weaponry against your own tissues. So in this case, patients with lupus have really high levels of B helper T cells that promote the production of antibodies or proteins, can sort of drive the whole process. And these cells are abnormally higher and abnormally activated in patients with lupus.
Okay, so the B cells are making what are called these autoantibodies that attack the body, correct?
That's right.
And the T cells are like generals telling them what to do.
That's right. We think that what really happens, one of the early sort of Adam and Eve events, is that there is a chemical imbalance in the blood of these patients. We found one molecule that was deficient or low in patients with lupus that seems to be driving all of the abnormal behavior that we're seeing. And this chemical imbalance leads to an abnormal upregulation and proliferation or higher numbers of these generals that are actually targeting self-tissue. And we think of them sort of as a switch that can turn the cells from bad guys to good guys.
So how do you flip the switch?
So we found that if we can actually give these molecules as sort of like a drug, that we can actually get these cells to be reprogrammed and instead of actually promoting the B cells and autoantibodies, to actually adopt a plan of potentially healing the wounds from the damage they caused in the various tissues.
Giving the generals a new plan of attack.
Or a plan of defense in this case. Our hope is that this kind of reprogram will allow them to repair the damage that they initially caused.
Well, how have you tested this so far in the lab?
So we've tested it in many, many different ways, but probably the most stunning way was that we actually applied the molecule to the blood of patients from lupus. And we found that even giving this molecule for short periods of time, we're able to reprogram them, deactivate their ability to help these B cells that make these autoantibodies or these abnormal proteins, and in fact, actually promote a wound healing type phenotype. And so I think that establishes a pretty good proof of principle. And so we really need to be able to show that this can work within people.
But you haven't tried it in people yet?
No, we haven't. But we are really excited about this because not only can we show that it works in the laboratory, but because we actually found is that most patients with lupus have a deficiency in this molecule. So we're not doing something totally new. We're actually just correcting a problem that occurs in patients with lupus. So if people with lupus have too low levels of this AHR molecules, it just stands to reason that by restoring this level, we can really improve, if not try to cure the disease.
Well, how far does this T cell switch in this molecule go towards explaining what actually causes someone to develop lupus in the first place?
Well, this is a great question. So we think that it actually is one of the earliest events. And so I give it the analogy of sort of if we can reprogram the T cells, potentially we can turn off the faucet. And the reason why we think this is because these chemical imbalances seem to be one of the earliest events of lupus, we think. And we think this is causing the T cells to have the problem, which are those immune cells, the generals. And then we think these generals are then giving instructions to the B cells, which is giving the final thing. So if you look at the layout that I just gave you, we think that we're actually hitting one of the first events that are occurring in patients with lupus. Obviously, there are other causes, you know, including sex. It's highly enriched in women, and there are some genetic causes. But in terms of molecules that are involved, we think this very early step is a really critical one that drives the whole process.
Now, does this mean that you have to catch the lupus early for this therapy to work?
We don't know that yet, Bob. We're hoping that this kind of reprogramming can have outsized effects for patients with disease. So our hope is that it not only affects people with early disease, but that it could also affect people with late-stage disease that could potentially lead to something like a cure. Mm-hmm.
We just heard about the powerful CAR T-cell therapy with some astonishing results, but it's highly individualized. How do you see this kind of strategy where you reprogram this lupus-promoting switch fitting into how we might treat the disease in the future?
So one of the things is that with this CAR T therapy, it's really expensive. It takes a lot of manufacturing in from the patient's blood, and potentially patients will actually have to undergo chemotherapy to be able to make this CAR T cell therapy better. And so the advantages of approaches like ours would be that it would be cheaper, faster to deliver, and potentially safer for a number of patients. But that really remains to be seen with clinical trials, which we're not ready to enter yet.
If it works for lupus, could we use this type of strategy to treat other autoimmune diseases?
In general, I think the idea of not just blocking or suppressing the immune system, but reprogramming the bad guys in autoimmune disease is a concept that we'd like to really push forward.
Mm. It's like pulling a weed out by the root.
That's right. Instead of just cutting off the top.
Dr. Choi, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much, Bob.
Dr. Jay Choi is an associate professor of dermatology and biochemistry at Northwestern University. And that's it for Quirks and Quarks this week. If you'd like to get in touch with us, our email is quirks@cbc.ca. Or just go to the contact link on our webpage at cbc.ca/quirks, where you can read my latest blog or listen to our audio archives. You can also follow our podcast, get us on SiriusXM, or download the CBC Listen app. It's free from the App Store or Google Play. Quirks and Quarks is produced by Rosie Fernandez, Amanda Buckowitz, and Sonia Biting. Our senior producer is Jim Lebbins. I'm Bob McDonald. Thanks for listening.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.